Good afternoon, and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live from 2 to 3 in the afternoon Pacific time. And yes, we are live. I'm in Mexico right now, and about 10 minutes ago, I was racing through the streets in a taxi cab to get back to my broadcasting equipment, and we did get it hooked up better today than yesterday, so it's working out, and we can be taking your calls. My one thing I don't have hooked up yet is my call screening software. That's happening as I speak. I'm working on it. Let's see. I have to add some code here. Okay, we'll talk first of all to Bruce from Las Vegas. Bruce, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thank you for having me, Steve.
Sure, good to hear from you.
Yeah, it's good to hear your voice, too. Daniel, with King Nebuchadnezzar, where he threw Shadrach and Abednego and Meshach in the fiery furnace.
Yeah.
And then, you know, he leaped to his feet in amazement, and he said, look, I see four men walking around the fire. I mean, what I'm trying to grasp is what this fiery furnace may have looked like, and, I mean, if it was that hot, the guards were killed before they even could, you know, I mean, they threw him in the fire, but the guards were killed because it was so blazing. And
yeah.
Then was that Jesus Christ walking around in there with him?
Well, Christians often think so. Yeah, Christians often believe so, and it's entirely possible that it was. Some people believe it was a pre-incarnate appearance of Christ. In the Old Testament, from time to time, you have examples of what they call theophanies, which is apparently Christ or God appearing in a human form to people in the Old Testament, even before Jesus came to earth as a man.
Okay.
And many people believe that this occurrence is one of those times. And therefore, they believe it was Jesus. Now, we don't have to believe it was Jesus.
Okay.
I don't, you know, the Jews, I'm sure, don't believe it was Jesus. It could have been an angel. I mean, it doesn't really say who it was.
The reason
Christians sometimes say it was Jesus is because Nebuchadnezzar himself said the fourth one looks like the Son of God. That's how it's stated in the King James Version. But the words of Nebuchadnezzar can also be translated the Son of the Gods or a Son of the Gods, which could just mean in the paganism of the Babylonians, which is, of course, the speaker was a Babylonian pagan. He could have been just saying he looks like a son of one of the gods, which could mean an angel or anything else. So all we know is from what Nebuchadnezzar said about the man's appearance. We don't really know the identity of the man. I believe that later on, when Daniel was in the lion's den, which was just a few chapters later, three chapters later, that Daniel said that the Lord had sent his angel to shut the mouths of the lions. So it might be reasonable to assume that God sent an angel to be with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the fire furnace too. But Christians have usually attributed that appearance to a pre-incarnate appearance of Christ.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you. Now, do you have time for one quick question?
Probably.
Okay. Now, as far as, you know, they got the dispensationalist view out there, is there going to be a future Antichrist? I mean, I'm not going with a dispensationalist here because I've been doing some more reading, and it more sounds like a more preterist view like you hold. But, like, you know, like the two witnesses and so forth, is that something yet to come, or is that something that already happened, or are we...
Well,
like,
you've got to take... You've got to take those things case by case in the book of Revelation, see, because some people believe it. Some people are preterists who believe that it was all fulfilled in the past. Others, of course, are futurists, and they think it's all going to be fulfilled in the future. But there's also a couple other views out there. There's the idealist view, which holds that these things are kind of fulfilled at all times more the ideals or the principles that are being depicted in a dramatic form that are always true principles. I mean, that's one view also. Then you've got the historicist view. And they believe that it's fulfilled throughout history. That is, that Revelation is a panoramic view of history from beginning to end, from John's time at least till the end. And each one would have a different opinion about who the two witnesses are. I myself believe the two witnesses represent the church at all times. But there are certainly different views. That's why... I mean, I'd definitely recommend that you consider reading my book, Revelation 4 Views, to get a grasp of what the different opinions are on that.
All right, I'll have to do that. Okay, because there is a lot of symbolism there, and I know it gets kind of complex. But all right, well, be careful in Mexico, Steve, and we'll pray for your safety, and God bless you, and I hope you have a great day.
Thanks, Bruce. God bless you. Thanks for your call.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye now. And we have another call from Las Vegas, and that's John from Las Vegas. We also have lines open for you. I don't know if I even gave out the number yet. Both these calls were waiting before I gave the number, so let me give it out. If you have a question about the Bible or about Christianity, or you have a difference of opinion from the host, and you'd like to be on the air with us, we're live between 2 and 3 in the afternoon Pacific time, and you can reach me here on the air at 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. And John, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thank you for calling.
Yes, thank you, Steve. And don't realize that we have you on fast dial.
Oh, that's great.
Before you get there, we're already dialing to get in. Listen, we appreciate your work, and I have a question for you. I was reading through Acts, and I came up to this part where they were kind of dividing or selling the things that they had and bringing it.
Yeah.
And then there's two people who at separate times brought something and kind of didn't give it all.
And well, Ananias and Sapphira, they were a married couple, yeah.
Yeah, so I'm trying to figure, that sounds like an Old Testament type of thing, yet it's in the New.
And I was you mean because they were struck dead?
Yeah, because usually in the Old Testament, I think God did that, you know, when they just didn't do something, they would just drop dead or be turned into salt or something.
Well, yeah, it happened very rarely in the Old Testament. Lot's wife turned to salt. Uzziah, who touched the ark, fell down dead. And you might find a couple other cases in the whole span of Old Testament history. There's at least two cases like that in the New Testament. One is the case of Ananias and Sapphira, which you're bringing up. And they were the ones who lied and tried to deceive the church. And they just dropped dead when they were exposed. But the other case is in chapter 12 of Acts, where Herod is giving a speech and people claim him to be a god. And the book of Acts says that the angel of the Lord struck him and he died. He was eaten with worms and he died. And that's actually a story that is known also from an independent account in Josephus. Josephus actually, who of course had never read the book of Acts and was not a Christian, but he was a Jewish historian of the time. He said that when Herod was giving that speech, that he doubled over in pain and had to be taken away, and he died like 3 days later of some kind of internal problems. Acts tells us that he was smitten by the angel of God and that worms ate him and he died. But those two occurrences are rather unusual in the book of Acts, but then those kinds of occurrences are unusual in the Old Testament too. I mean, if you could find, let us say, 10 cases in the Old Testament, which you can't, I don't think. I don't think you can find even 4, but maybe you could. But if you could find 10 in the Old Testament, it would still be very rare because the Old Testament covers 4,000 years. And so that would be like, on average, once every 400 years. Whereas the book of Acts covers maybe 40 years. And you've got two times there in that time. So in a sense, it's more common in the New Testament than it is in the Old.
Yeah. Well, what just struck me on that is that I know it was an Old Testament, but I think at certain times there was wars where the guys had to do very little and the enemy would just kind of...
kill each other. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, there were wars in the Old Testament. It wasn't so much that God struck the enemies, you know, just struck them dead, but he confused the enemies so they killed each other. That happened when Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, was overrun by his enemies. And it also happened in Gideon's war in the book of Judges. So you do have some cases like that where God allowed Israel to win without really fighting.
Right. Well, I'm just saying, so is there's no explanation for that. I mean, other than God just did it that way.
Right, right. And he doesn't do it very often. You know, he didn't do it very often in biblical times. And he doesn't do it often now. But I think that finding it both in the Old Testament and in the New Testament would be indicative that might be the kind of thing that would still happen on occasion, even now. I mean, I don't know of any cases, but that God might strike somebody dead is not unthinkable. It's just not very common.
Yeah, all right. Because I thought, again, now, when in the area, I mean, in the era that they were in, were they under grace at that time, or were they under the law?
Oh, they were certainly under grace, yeah. I mean, this was during the New Testament time, after after the Holy Spirit had been sent at Pentecost.
Yeah. And these people were supposedly Christians?
Well, who can say? They were in the church, but they might not have been true Christians. Peter said that Satan had filled their hearts to lie to the Holy Spirit. And if Satan filled their hearts, I don't know if that would allow that they were Christians or not.
Hmm. Interesting. Well, we thank you again, and we certainly enjoy you in Las Vegas. So keep up the good work.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed being on in Las Vegas, and I like getting calls from people like you. Thank you, John.
All right. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye now. All right. Our next caller is Rashad, calling from Elmont, New York. Rashad, welcome to The Narrow Path, and thanks for calling.
No problem, Steve. My question today is this. You had a caller ask the thing. This is probably like a follow-up to the question that this person asked yesterday. They asked about Christians in the army.
Yes.
They were asking about Christians in the army and killing.
Sure.
And all that stuff. Kind of an expansion on that.
Well, sure.
I preface it by saying this, that you know, like you, I understand that when it says thou shalt not kill, it means, you know, thou shalt not murder. Meaning,
right.
You know, going out there and, you know, killing maliciously, you know, with no reason behind it.
Uh-huh.
You know, but anyway, my question is this.
Yeah, it definitely speaks of unjust killing.
Yeah. But my question is this. People who have, like, extreme, you know,
pacifist. Uh-huh.
Where did they get the idea that Jesus was the same way, and that all Christians should be the same way? And when I hear people explain away situations, it boggles my mind. Well, I was on a forum and I actually heard somebody actually said that they think it's wrong for not even wrong, but it's disgusting that a Christian could be a police officer and have to use violent means to stop a perpetrator.
Are you talking about the caller yesterday, or are you talking about a different time?
No. This is on a forum.
Oh, on the forum. Okay.
Mm-hmm. On a forum, not your forum, but a forum.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah. And. Yeah, our caller didn't mention police work, and I know you're a policeman yourself in New York. But, yeah, our caller was talking about soldiers, but certainly one would think that some of the issues in soldiery would be the same as the issues in police work. And one thing we do know is that there were policemen in Israel. They were actually soldiers in the Roman army, but they weren't fighting any wars. They were just a peacekeeping force. They were an occupational force. And some of them actually got saved. You know, we know that Jesus spoke highly of the faith of one of the centurions. And, you know, Cornelius was a centurion who got saved. Now, some people say, well, see, those guys became saved and they didn't have to quit their work. And that may be true. Maybe they didn't. I don't know if they did or not. They were policemen more than they were. I mean, they were really technically soldiers, but they were doing police work. They were not waging war. And one might argue from that Jesus saw there to be a legitimate place for believers in the peacekeeping or the police force. If so, if that is a lesson we took from that, then it would also follow that there'd be probably a place for believers in certain kinds of military forces where the military was only doing such things as amount to large-scale police work. Waging war is more controversial because in police work, although sometimes innocent people get themselves killed, it's always undesired. You know, the police never want to hurt an innocent person, and it's always a scandal when they do. But the police are generally speaking just aiming at the people who are the lawbreakers. Whereas in war, it's much more general. You know, we're still technically aiming at just the enemy combatants, but sometimes a lot of civilians get themselves killed too, and it's a somewhat different situation, at least for Christians. Christians often feel that it's wrong for a Christian to be involved in anything where innocent people would get killed through their actions, and some believe it's wrong for Christians even to be involved in killing guilty people. But that's been something that there's been a difference of opinion about for many hundreds of years. How have you resolved that? Now, were you a Christian before you were a policeman?
Yeah, I was a Christian before I was a police officer.
Yeah.
And, I understood it the same way that I looked at it as far as this, where is it that Paul writes that God puts the government there to
punish evildoers, and says the state does not bear the sword in vain. Yeah, that's Romans 13, and also 1 Peter 2.
Yeah, and I think the extreme pacifism can get to a ridiculous level where, you know, like I said, on a forum, you know, person basically suggested that they would see somebody getting attacked on the street and just walk by and not even call the police.
Hmm.
And you're like, how could he even think that way?
There's
no way I could see that Jesus would think that was the right thing to do.
You know what I think happens, Rashad, is that Jesus was teaching against legalism in his teachings, but people sometimes take what Jesus taught and take it in a legalistic way. That is, they just act as if the Sermon on the Mount becomes another law, just a more strict one. You know, and that Jesus is just the same kind of legalist that the Pharisees were, but he just had stricter standards. And one of his standards was you have to turn the other cheek. But I believe that when Jesus taught on those things, in my opinion, he was trying to illustrate what the radical nature of loving your neighbor and loving your enemy even. And yet, to say that you have to love your enemy doesn't mean that you cannot do anything that would be helpful to somebody who's one of the victims of a criminal. You see, Jesus talked about if someone strikes you on the right cheek, turn the other one to him also. If somebody wants to sue you and take your coat, give him your cloak also. If somebody asks you for anything, give it to him. If somebody makes you go a mile, go too. Jesus is talking about how you respond to people who would be, in a sense, aggravating you. That you love them. They are your enemies. They are making themselves your enemies, but you are making yourself their friend. But the policeman, police officer, excuse me, and in many respects a soldier too, is not dealing with his own personal enemies. He's hired by the state to do something that the state is authorized by God to do. Now, the question of whether Christians ought to be agents of the state is another controversial matter. But certainly most Christians in America have felt that it's quite legitimate, since they would say if we don't have Christians in those positions, then even though we have a largely, a large representation of Christians in the public, we'd be governed entirely by non-Christians. So it's a matter that's prickly. And I don't judge any other Christians for how they resolve the matter. I myself lean toward pacifism, but I don't believe it's wrong to do police work. And I believe that even if, if somebody is breaking into my house, I'm going to kill my children, or into my neighbor's house, I'm going to kill his children. And if I was there and had the ability to stop them, I would.
Yeah, I think is the right thing, because don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that, let me say it this way, when you're, if you're a Christian, you're not gonna go out and seek violence. You're not gonna go out and seek bad situations that you could quote unquote help somebody get out of something. But if you like you're saying, if you're in a situation and you have the opportunity to help, you help.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's it. I mean, if the Good Samaritan had come along while the man was being beaten up by the thieves, there's a possibility that he would have tried to defend the man against the thieves that were beating him up. That would be as helpful to him as the things he did later on for the man. I mean, as the story goes, the Good Samaritan found the man after he'd already been beaten up, and he did what he could to help. But if he'd gotten there a few hours earlier or a few minutes earlier, when the man was being assaulted, we presume the Good Samaritan would have done what he could do to help in that situation, too.
Yeah, I, I, I can definitely agree with that. But
yeah.
Just one last thing regarding this. As far as like related issue, as far as like self defense, the way I see as far as self defense goes is, you know, just to use a scenario that happens daily, because I hear it on the radio.
Yeah.
When we're receiving jobs, because the way it works is that as a police officer, we have the radio on our side, and Central gives us jobs to go to. So, you know, you hear the jobs come over, saying, you know, you go to the scene, and it, you know, somebody just happens to be walking down the street, when somebody decides to strike him in the face and try to rob him that way or something.
Yeah.
And, you know, I use myself as an example. If I'm walking down the street and somebody just decks me in the face, you know, I'm gonna try to get my composure to see what's going on.
Yeah.
And try to get out, and if I could get out of there without resorting to, you know, violence against the person, then I'll try to do that. But if the person keeps attacking me and I can't get away, then I would try to defend myself. What do you think about situations like that?
Well, I think that would be legitimate. It depends on what the situation is. You know, I think that when Jesus talks about turning the other cheek, and when he talks about going a second mile and things like that, in the Sermon on the Mount, all of the situations he gives are situations where there is not a lethal attack on anyone. I mean, being hit across the face is not a lethal attack. Being made to go a second mile or 1 mile is not a lethal attack. And it's hard to say, because Jesus doesn't give any examples like that, whether you should defend yourself if the attack was more deadly. Some Christians I know who are generally pacifistic in some ways would say, well, wait a minute, you know, you don't own yourself. And if you have a wife, if you have children, then you have obligations to them, too. I mean, for you to stand there and let someone kill you when you could escape or when you could do something to prevent it is to do something that you're preventing your children from becoming orphans and your wife from becoming a widow. You're actually serving somebody else's interest, not your own. Now, I myself feel that every Christian should be prepared to die for Jesus and, should not be afraid to die. But there are times when one might argue, well, I'm not doing this assailant any good by letting him kill me. You know, up to this point, he's not a murderer yet. If he kills me, he becomes a murderer. Then he has a lot to answer for. He's got innocent blood on his hands. He would even have a stiffer penalty in the courts, presumably, if he gets arrested for murdering me than for just assaulting me. I mean, to love your neighbor, even to love your assailant, doesn't mean that you would never lift a finger to prevent him from doing what he's doing. Because he's hurting himself, too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I believe it's a very nuanced subject. And I think when people just lay down rules and say, always do it this way, always do it that way, they're not recognizing how nuanced it is and how many other people's concerns are. A lot of people just want to take the words of Jesus and make it like it's a law, just like he wrote it in just like it was in the Talmud or something like that, you know, or just like it was some legalistic code. And what Jesus is doing is he's replacing legalism with a new order of behavior, which is to act in love toward people, even toward people who are hostile towards you. And he gives examples of how a radical love for people who are hostile to you might exhibit itself in several examples he gives. But he does not, I don't think he implies that there would never be any situation where it would be loving for you to resist a person's evil behavior. You know, if somebody has an abscessed tooth and, someone goes in with some pliers and pulls the tooth out, that's often a painful situation. Not as much now that we have painkillers, but in ancient times they had to do it. And, they didn't have painkillers. That was very painful. It hurt the person, but it was good for them. It was something they needed. I sometimes mention that when my son broke his arm, by the time we got to the doctor, by the time emergency room would see us, his arm had to be rebroken before it could be set. Now, I would never break my son's arm, but it had to be rebroken, you know, and I had to give permission to the doctor because he was a minor. My son was a minor. I had to give permission to do it, and it was a hard thing to do. but it's because I love my son that I gave permission to break his arm again. Now, if my son was about to do something insane, and let's say he's about to kill somebody, and I could stop him by breaking his arm, I'd sooner do that to my son than break his arm just so his arm's not crooked. I'd rather keep him from becoming a murderer. There, and if it was somebody else trying to kill me, I would think it'd be the loving thing to do what you can to stop him too. Now, to use deadly force is a harder thing to justify for a non-policeman. You know, I mean, I'm not a police officer, so I wouldn't feel good using deadly force. But I do believe that the Bible teaches, even in the New Testament, that some crimes are worthy of death, and that a person who commits them is basically earning death. That's what they're asking for. They're doing things they know are worthy of death. They may hope to get away with it, but they are signing away their right to life by doing something that the Bible says you do this and you should die.
Yep. I think as far as like a regular civilian, it's the way it works is like even for us, it has to be deadly force has to be necessary in that situation. Like if somebody's coming at you with a baseball bat and they're 15 feet away from you, and you have a gun, believe it or not, you can close 15 feet, even 15 yards, you can close pretty quickly.
Yeah, if someone's running at you. Yeah.
But strike you in the head with a baseball bat and presumably kill you.
Yeah.
So, you know, the way we're trained is like we're trained to match or exceed the threat that we're being faced with. So if somebody has a toothpick in their hand, you know, you're not going to shoot them.
Yeah.
Because it's not justifiable. But like with a regular civilian, if somebody's coming at them with a knife, and they have a gun and they have no choice but to shoot the person, and the person dies, it'd be justifiable. But you know, you have crooked lawyers out there that would try to turn things on you and get money for the person's family. You know, they were trying to kill you, but that's how it works.
Yeah. Well, Rashad, I'm gonna have to move along, but as you've pointed out, and I agree, this is much more of a complex issue than most people make it. I think a lot of people when they think about either police work or military work, they just assume one way or the other. They either assume it's legitimate or they assume it's not legitimate, depending on some particular, you know, leaning they have. Whereas, in fact, you really have to assess the different situations, because police work can be a legitimate thing or an illegitimate thing, depending on certain circumstances. And the same thing is true of, I think, defending your family or whatever, you know, or defending your nation. It's complex. It's nuanced. But I think that I don't think that God has some kind of a checklist up there, and, you know, resisting somebody who's attacking you is one of those things that he checks off against you when you do it. I think when God judges us, he's going to judge us for whether we are acting on the principles of Christian love, whether we're being led by the Spirit, certainly a Christian would never hurt somebody else cruelly or with with malicious intent. But there are times when hurting somebody can be the best thing you can do for them.
Yep. I agree with that.
And sometimes it's the only thing you can do to help a whole bunch of other people from being unjustly hurt.
Exactly. I agree with that. But anyway, Steve, I don't want to take up too much of your time. I know you have other calls waiting.
Okay, Rashad. Thanks for your call.
Okay, no problem, Steve. Take care.
All right. Bye now. All right, our next caller is also from Las Vegas. That makes three from Las Vegas today, as well as Rashad from New York. If you'd like to be on the air, we have a line open for you, and you can call from anywhere. You don't have to be in Las Vegas or New York to call. You just have to have a phone, and the number is 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. Ephraim from Las Vegas, thanks for calling, and welcome to the Narrow Path.
How's it going?
I'm all right, thanks.
I was just wanted to... you guys are talking about if it's okay to be a cop or a soldier.
Uh-huh.
Well, we can agree that the God of the Old Testament and the New Testament are the same, and that he's a god of structure and order, and that all these positions man didn't just think of. There's army in heaven, there's army in hell, there's army on earth, and all these, like it says, to obey whoever you have above you, putting you out to do the things. I believe that it is okay to go out, and if you're a soldier and that's your job to do it, or a police officer, because it's not, the world ain't of disorder the way God made it, it was of order, correct?
Yeah, but before, I mean, I'm not going to say you're wrong, but let me tell you where some of the exceptions might be in the way some people would think, including myself on some issues. It's true. In the Old Testament, God had Israel maintain armies, and they fought wars against their enemies, and God is the same God today. Well, God's the same God today. But the program he's involved in on earth is somewhat different than them, because in the Old Testament, he was trying to maintain a nation of people, an ethnic nation in a certain geographical territory, which was threatened by aggressors on every side. But his intention was to keep that group of people alive as a nation and to use, you know, their soldiers and so forth to do it. And so he intervened in their wars and things like that, in order to preserve them at times. Other times, when it was when he felt it was necessary to judge them, he would let them lose. Now, in the New Testament, there isn't a nation like that, that God has. God's people are anyone who believes in Christ, and they belong to all nations. Now, here's what gets difficult. In the Old Testament, if the Babylonians or the Assyrians or the Edomites or the Moabites attacked Israel, everybody knew which side God was on. He was on the side of his people, Israel. And the bad guys were all pagans, and they worshipped devils and false gods. Now, in a war today between two nations, let's say between us and China, if it ever came to that. Well, there's...
I don't want to interrupt you, but I'm sorry to interrupt you. My phone's about to die, so I'm going to just listen in on
okay.
your call.
That's fine.
I want to just cut out.
Sure. Go ahead and listen on the radio. Thanks for your call. Yep.
Bye
now. But... In a war, for example, between the United States and China, it seems to me there's at least 100 million Christians in China. And I don't think there's that many in America. There might be. But the point is, it seems to me there's a good chance that a Christian American soldier would be shooting across the field at a Christian Chinese soldier. Now, that's different than the Old Testament situation. In the Old Testament, it was God's people. If Israel was at war, they were God's people against some pagan nation that was every last man in that pagan nation was a worshiper of Baal or of Molech or of some demon god. Where now the people of God are distributed in every nation. And the wars between nations are no longer wars between God's people and someone else. And that's why we don't have an exact parallel between the Old Testament and the New Testament in this respect. In the New Testament, we have a situation where God is not necessarily on the side of any nation. I mean, we think, of course, he's by default on our side. But in World War II, the Germans thought he was on their side. The Italians thought he was on their side. The Japanese didn't believe in God, probably, but they believed that they probably had some divine mandate from their emperor. Everyone thought that they were in the right and had some higher sanction for what they were doing. And the interesting thing, of course, is that there, in our war, in World War II, against Germany, there were a lot of Christian German soldiers and a lot of American Christian soldiers. And they were shooting at each other, killing each other. Now, that's a different kind of a situation than we have in the Old Testament where, you know, somebody who's just a bloodthirsty pagan trying to wipe out the nation of Israel gets himself shot by an Israelite or killed in war, whereas when you've got Christians on both sides and they're shooting at each other, that is a problem that in more ways than one. One is that Jesus said the world will know that Jesus was sent by the Father because the Christians have unity with each other. Now, Christians who are shooting each other don't have unity with each other. Furthermore, if I, as a Christian, am in a foxhole with another American who's not a Christian, let's say an American atheist and I are in a foxhole shooting across the field at, let us say, a Russian army. And in the foxhole on the other side, you've got a Russian Christian and a Russian atheist side by side. The interesting thing is that in that situation, my solidarity is being with this atheist in the foxhole with me, who happens to be an American. And that Russian Christian solidarity is with the atheist in the foxhole with him, who's a Russian. And I don't think that's normal. I don't think that's how God intended things to be. That's like being unequally yoked together with unbelievers in fighting against other believers in some cases. Now, this is why I said it's a very nuanced and complicated subject. And, you know, what we need is not a few minutes on a radio program to solve this problem. It would take a Bible conference for all the arguments on both sides to be weighed, to be counterbalanced, to be counter-argued, and so forth. And so that's why sound like I'm being a little wishy-washy on this, I don't think I am wishy-washy, but I'm saying that I see how the biblical principles are applied by people on one side of the aisle, and I see how the biblical principles are being applied by people on the other side of the aisle. And it's not just a slam dunk where one person's side says, okay, we clearly win, because there are a lot of nuances, and that's where a Christian needs to be led by God's Holy Spirit, needs to make sure they're walking in love, even toward those who are their enemies, needs to make sure they're walking in love toward their neighbors, too, if they're under attack from their enemies. So those are kinds of the matters that we're not going to settle on this radio program. I don't intend ever to be able to settle it for everybody. It's good enough for me if I can settle it for me as to what I'm supposed to do. And even that, I don't decide on the basis of some rule, but on the basis of, I believe, how all of my Christian convictions in a given situation will synthesize into a course of action. And that's something, I mean, Christians would rather have a list of rules to make these kind of decisions easier. But walking in the Spirit is much more of a challenge. And that's why more Christians do religious things than walk in the Spirit, because it is more challenging to try to walk in the Spirit of Jesus than to just memorize a bunch of rules and just keep them. Let's talk to Ann from Boring, Oregon next. Hi, Ann. Welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hi, Steve. I liked your take on what you just spoke about. And it's interesting. The question I have is, last night they replayed on the History Channel and you were on the first segment. And, you know,
about the Revelation, yeah.
Right. And then the next segment, it started at 10, they spoke about the books that they found called the Books of War. That apparently the Essenes had written.
Uh-huh.
And I've never heard of that before, and I was wondering if you had a take on that. It seemed to most of what they had written on the scrolls were parallel with Revelation. And if you'd like to comment on that, I'd appreciate it.
Well, I've never read the Books of War, so I've never read any of the Essene documents, actually, although they are available to read. They're just not, it hasn't been a top priority of mine. They are interesting because they reflect the thoughts of a religious community in Israel around the same time as Christ was around. But it's not a community that, as far as we know, had any dealings with Christians. We don't know of any Christians evangelizing the Essenes. We don't think the Essenes had any contact with Jesus, probably none with John the Baptist either, although some people might think otherwise. But the point is, the Essene writings would be of interest in the same way that perhaps finding writings by the Pharisees would be. The Essenes were a Jewish sect, contemporary with the Pharisees, contemporary with the early Christians, and they had their own religious library, which has, of course, been found in the Dead Sea Scrolls. And anyway, any correspondence or any similarity in their writings to the Book of Revelation would not strike me as very strange, because the Book of Revelation was written in a fashion, in a genre, that was a very common genre among Jewish writers at the time, and Christian writers, but especially Jewish writers, for about two centuries before Jesus was born. Jews wrote books that were in the same style as the book of Revelation before Revelation came along. Revelation, when it was written in a style that was very common and very popular at the time. If the Essenes wrote some books about war that were using imagery like the book of Revelation, it would not be too strange. They were no doubt influenced by Daniel, by Zechariah, by Ezekiel, and by the apocalyptic writings of the Old Testament, as well as the apocalyptic writings of the intertestamental period. That is the time between the Old and the New Testament. That's when most of the so-called apocalyptic writings were produced. So without having read them, I would say that if you found tremendous similarities between the Essene writings and the book of Revelation, that would not be surprising, because Revelation, when it was written, deliberately exhibited great similarities with a fairly large body of Jewish writings. And if the Essenes had some of their own of that style, I wouldn't find anything surprising about that at all.
Well, do you know where a person could, I suppose if you went online, which I don't have a computer, but that's where they could be found? I mean, like I said, this is the first time I'd heard about them.
I assume that going online would be the safest way to locate them, or the quickest way. You can buy translations of the Dead Sea Scrolls just in book form at any, Borders bookstore or whatever. Just go into their section or ask what section they'd find them in, probably the religion section. But you can find English translations of the Dead Sea Scrolls. But I think there may be some of the scrolls still not translated yet, and maybe these, I don't know very much about this, what's it called, the books of war or something like that? I don't know very much about that.
Okay.
But I assume they're part of the Dead Sea Scrolls. If they're from the Essenes, I would expect that to be so. Yeah.
Right. Okay. May I just make one comment?
Mm-hmm.
It came up about the two witnesses. I've, struggled with that for a long time, and because it did refer to Moses and Elijah. Those are the two that were transfigurated?
Yeah, well, Moses and Elijah did appear with Christ in the transfiguration, yes.
And I'm just wondering if perhaps when they used the term Moses and Elijah, that was the two witnesses, because that would be a witness of resurrection.
Well, that's interesting, because Moses and Elijah on the Mount of Transfiguration with Jesus were talking with him about the exodus that he was going to accomplish in Jerusalem, which would certainly mean his death and resurrection. And so, in a sense, they would be bearing witness. Though a witness is usually one who speaks about something to somebody who needs to hear about it. In other words, if Moses and Elijah had spoken to Peter and James and John there on the mountain of Transfiguration and spoken to them about what Jesus could do, then they'd be bearing witness to the apostles about it. I don't know if they were bearing witness to Jesus about it, because he already knew. But maybe they were. Maybe they were informing him. Because I think the first time that he ever mentioned it to his disciples that he would die and rise again was immediately before that. Come think of it. It was before that. At Caesarea Philippi, he made the first reference to that. And then so he didn't need to be told by them. But in the book of Revelation, chapter 11, when it talks about the two witnesses, it doesn't mention Moses and Elijah, but the reason that the two witnesses are often linked with Moses and Elijah in people's minds is because of some of the things that are said about them. For example, the two witnesses have the power to call fire out of heaven on their enemies and stop the rain from coming on the ground for 3.5 years. Well, those are two things Elijah did. Elijah, on one occasion, called fire out of heaven, and he also stopped the rain for 3.5 years. But it also says about them that they could smite the earth with plagues and they could turn water into blood. Well, those are things that's Moses' activity. So in other words, of the four types of miraculous things that are attributed to them, two of them are reminiscent of Elijah and two of them are reminiscent of Moses. And that's why very often people have associated them with Moses and Elijah.
Well, I was just a thought, and may I just make another comment?
Uh-huh.
With the gentleman that was talking about war. Obviously, I'm not against war. However, I prayed. I have three sons, and I prayed to say none of them during that time would be drafted.
Uh-huh.
And they weren't. And then I had a grandson about a year ago that was going to go into the Guards. And I prayed against that. And he was just getting ready to have a physical, and he found he had a broken toe and I think his shoulder. And I said, thank you, Jesus.
Yeah. During World War II, my father was in the Coast Guard, but he didn't want to kill anybody. And he actually prayed. He was a Christian man. He prayed that God would prevent him from having to ever kill anybody in his whole, career in the Coast Guard. And though he was near combat areas, he never actually had to see combat face to face, never had to kill anybody. So he felt his prayers were answered about that. I think what I have to say is I'm not against war per se, but I am against most wars. I mean,
that's
God,
what I
yeah, God can use war, but most wars are, someone's doing something really nasty and evil. That's why they happen. Now, sometimes one side in a war is demonstrably more righteous than the other side. However, in every war, both sides think they're the righteous side. And that's why it's difficult for me to assume that we're the good guys as often as we think we are. Now, certainly in World War II, it seems rather like, if you're going to assign good guy and bad guy status to the two sides, certainly the Allies seem like the good guys because they were the ones who were trying to prevent tyranny and aggression and the slaughter of innocent Jews and things like that. But most wars aren't that clear. Most wars are over more obscure goals, like, who knows what the Gulf War was about. Most of us believe it was about oil, but lots of people say it was just about preserving, coming to the aid of our allies. But, we hardly ever hear the real reasons why we go to war. There's a lot of people who say that George W. Bush lied about the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Now, I don't personally think he lied. I personally think that he believed they were there. And therefore, even if he is wrong, I don't think he lied. But the point is, there's a lot of people who question the official story about that. Why were we going over there anyway? Well, some people think it was just because, George Bush wanted to finish up the legacy of his father. Other people think there was a legitimate danger to the U.S. there. And I'm not going to, I don't even know. I don't even know what the right one is. But that's just the point. Whenever our nation goes to war, who really knows why we're really doing it? Unless it's very obvious. And most of our wars, it's not very obvious. I mean, we have the story that's given to us in the news, and maybe we're getting the right story, maybe we're not. Who can say? It would seem to me that because of the propaganda machine that every nation runs during times of war, that every nation thinks that their side is the good guys. And therefore, if we think we're the good guys, that's not unique. We may not be. We can be, and in some cases I believe we are. But I don't have a rose-colored set of glasses I wear in assessing America's involvement in wars. I believe the CIA has been involved in some pretty nasty stuff in the past, and we could say, the end justifies the means because, the guys they took out were bad guys and so forth. But, I mean, assassinating people who are bad guys, that's dirty business. I don't really know that a Christian belongs in that kind of activity. I don't think so. But then, I don't know what's going on. And I don't think I have access to that information. That's the point. And therefore, I do know that God has given me a warfare to be involved in, which is a spiritual warfare. And that if we all did that a little better than we're doing it, maybe a lot better, there would be fewer wars for us to have to wonder about. Because we're supposed to be out there capturing men's minds for Christ through the gospel and through our holy lives and through our Christian community. The dynamics of the testimony of a Christian community. These things are not happening because Christians are totally compromising. And because of that, our warfare is going unfought, and then we end up stuck with the world's wars because we haven't done our job. That's my nutshell assessment of that situation.
Yeah. I agree with you wholeheartedly. I'll leave with a story, and it's supposed to be a true story that when we were fighting over in France, I believe it was France against Germans, that Christmas Eve, they all stopped fighting and sang together. Christmas song, Christian song. And I think that tells us a lot. And if people would think about it for a while, I just, I'm like you, I'm not against the war per se, but it has bothered me, just like you said, that we have Christians killing Christians, and I just can't handle it. I just don't agree with it. So, Steve, you've done a great job, and just keep it up. And I've got a thousand other questions, things, but I'm going to let you go now on the...
Okay, well, I actually don't have time to take another call because I'm going to be hearing the music in about 2 minutes. If you do have another question on hand, you've got the floor.
Oh, gosh. You caught me off guard.
I thought so. I didn't want to put you on the spot. But
well, next time I'll write him down because, yeah, and I'll call you again. And thank you for your stand and your ministry.
All right. Well, God bless you, Ann.
Oh, wait a minute. Yeah. A friend of mine wants to know when you're coming up. We saw you a few years back over in Camas.
Oh, did you? Okay.
Yeah. And I had received another notice, but I had been gone for a couple of years and wasn't able to. And we're just wondering when you're coming up in this area again.
Yeah, I'm getting asked that more and more lately because it's been a while. I like to think of coming up there 3 or 4 times a year, but I get so busy with other things that it's hard to get it in. But I really think I'm overdue for a trip up there soon. So I'm thinking maybe, I don't know, maybe January. I'm not sure.
Okay.
But I'll be announcing it on the air, and it'll be on the website when I get something nailed down.
All right. Thank you, Steve, and God bless you.
Okay, Ann. God bless you, too. Thanks for your call.
Uh-huh. Bye-bye.
Bye now. All right. Well, we don't have very much time here. The music's going to start playing in about 30 seconds, so let me just give you some information. In case you're not aware, you've been listening to The Narrow Path radio broadcast. This is a daily program, an hour a day from 2 to 3 in the afternoon Pacific time, live, where you can call in if you have questions about the Bible or about Christianity, or if you disagree with something, you want to get that off your chest, you want to argue a point, feel free to do that here. We've been doing this for about 12 years, and we do this by paying radio stations to carry the program. I don't get paid, and no one gets paid at this end. We pay to go on the air. Sometimes I pay out of my own pocket, but most of the time, it's listeners who cover the bills. And it's a good thing, too, because I couldn't pay out of my own pocket very often. But if you'd like to help us stay on the air on the radio station you're listening to, or for that matter, if you listen on the Internet, just know that if we go off the air on the radio, we'll be off the air on the Internet, too, it looks like. So we do have bills, about $10,000 a month, and those all come from listeners. If you'd like to help us pay those bills, you can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 3633, Santa Cruz, California, 95063. That's The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 3633, Santa Cruz, California, 95063. I want you to know our website also is just loaded with resources. MP3 files by the hundreds, nearly 1,000 of them there, I think, of lectures. MP3 lectures of mine, teaching verse by verse through the whole Bible, teaching on hundreds of different subjects. There's some debates there that I've done with other Christians and even with an atheist, I think, that's up there too. But it's all free. If you just go to our website, you just take whatever you want. You can listen to the stuff there. You can download it, put it on your iPod, whatever you want. The website is www.thenarrowpath.com. That's the same as the name of the program, thenarrowpath.com. My name is Steve Gregg. I appreciate you joining us today. Thanks for calling. Those of you who did, I'll be, Lord willing, able to conduct the show again tomorrow, the last day of our broadcast week. Hope you'll be there. Please tune in, and we'll continue this discussion at that time. God bless you.